hands were softened, they were all blistered, and there'd been a lot of alterations done in the mill, so that the number of men required to run the mills
was less
than it hitherto had been. But we started all the men that had been there when they were closed down, and after 3 weeks we'd more or less got the thing running properly.
Mm.
And we had to decide to finish the men.
Mm.
It was heartbreaking. And the manager, my boss, a man called Stuart North, who was a wonderful man, straight, army captain, straight as a die, and he couldn't tell men to finish.
Mm.
He was so tender-hearted.
Yeah.
Seeing these men that did you know, work, when they came back, you know, and worked, they worked hard. And I was given the job of deciding who should be finished and who shouldn't.
It was pretty hard.
I wouldn't like to do it again.
No.
It was awful. It was awful. And then you had to tell these men.
Mm.
And they hadn't a prospect of getting a job, not a prospect. It was awful. It was one of the nastiest times I remember, telling men who'd worked themselves to a standstill to get the mill going, had worked themselves out of a job, you see.
Yeah.
No redundancy payment, anything like this. And then I was in charge of all the casual labourer in the times of the Depression in the 30s. These people today talk about the 30s, they don't know what they're talking about, you know, they haven't a clue.
Mm.
These politicians.
Mm.
I haven't a clue how hard they were.
Mm.
I remember, and I was in charge of all the casual labour. There were, in works, there were days when you wanted people and days when you didn't want them.
Mm.
So there was always a, and they had a big cabin where they assembled in the mornings, and I used to go and tell them how many I wanted, you see, to start to work. And there was what they called a means test in those days, and if they'd been on the dole so long, they were taken off the dole and put on the pan crack, it was called.
Yes, yeah.
You might have heard about it. And if you had so many stamps, you were still eligible for the proper dole.
Yeah.
I think it was 18 shillings a week. And I've gone into this cabin and I would say, I want six men today, and I would mention the names. And the men would say, Mr. Beelby, do you mind giving so-and-so the day's work today? You see, if he doesn't get a stamp,
really?
He'll be on the pan crack.
Uh-huh.
And they would give up
a
day's work so that somebody in a poorer state than they were would get it. You know, it's remarkable.
Mm.
I always admired those men.
Mm.
I admired
them.
And when they worked, there was no need for anybody to supervise them. You just told them, do that. It was done. There was no... Well, people, if you didn't work, you didn't eat. That was the position. But I always admired the men that hadn't anything themselves.
Mm.
But they would forego a day's work so that the man hadn't they gone to the dreaded pan crack?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Mm. Of course, I was happy 19 then. 19. Fancying I was in charge of men.
You'd done quite well then to be.
Oh, well, I was regarded as one of the up and comings, you see.
Yeah.
But you had to work. I mean,
yeah.
I went to Constantine College. I was one of the first pupils. We were pupils at Constantine College before it opened.
Yeah.
We had huts in the high school ground.
Oh, yeah.
I studied metallurgy and Spanish. Very well with the Spanish. But, it was called the Constantine College. It's the Polytechno, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
So, did you go there out of...
In the evenings.
Evening classes.
Oh, yes, there was no day release or anything like that. It was evening classes you went.
And did you have to pay for those, or was it? Did you have to pay for classes?
I don't think so. I don't remember, you know. I don't.
Mm.
I would have remembered I'd paid. I think they were free.
Mm.
You had to buy your books and things.
Yeah.
I mean, you had to buy your books and things. They were very good. It was a very good. I did research there. Years afterwards, I did research on welding. I tested the welds. It was all hand welding. There was no machine welding in those. Oxyacetylene welding, and this the metal used to get overheated and weaken it. You see, and not properly welded. So I did a series of fatigue tests. The first all-welded bridge in the world was at just over the bridge at Newport.
Yes.
Over the railway bridge at Newport. Let me see. It would be over the lift bridge. Was that up then? I'm not sure now. Yes, it'd be the lift bridge. And yon side of the lift bridge, before you get to the ICI proper, there's a railway bridge over some railway lines, the Middlesbrough and Middlesbrough line. And that was a welded bridge.
Yeah.
And they've never welded a bridge before. It was all riveted.
Yeah.
And I did all these fatigue tests to make sure that the steel would be all right.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that at Considine College. Used to make specimens and put them in the machines and run them for days until they eventually broke. So it was a very good college, Constantine. The first principal was a man called Dr. Ingall. He was a marvellous man. I don't know where he came, he was a marvellous fella. Then there was Mr. Groves, who was my particular master. He was a good man. Yes, but very good. Oh yes, you could get on, you know.
Yes.
Everybody had a chance to get on in those days.
So. I mean, you
could reach a pinnacle or so far up the pinnacle, but everybody had a chance if you worked. You could do all right. But I remember a lad called. He was the biggest dumb cluck in the world. And yet he became a very prominent town councillor in Middlesbrough. There's a you could do things in those days. You could do things. But he had to work. I mean, he had to work. He could read and write when he left school, but he was below average. But he must have developed afterwards, you see. Oh yes, if you worked, you could get places. And if you went into shipping, which was a job people tried to get into, you worked nearly 24 hours a day in shipping, but eventually you became a ship owner, which was important, you see.
How about the Second World War? You were obviously...
Second World War, I was in the Home Guard.
Yeah?
I was. I was in the Works Home Guard first. And then the order came that you had to be in the Home Guard in the village where you lived, so I had to come to this one. Yes, it was hard work.
Yeah.
Dawn to dusk at night, you know, and then going to work to the next day. It was harder than being in the army.
Yes.
Much harder.
So when had you moved out here to Moss?
1937.
And was that when you got married, or was it before?
Yes, we got married.
Then?
Yes. Pa bought me a house in St. Germain's Grove. That's, you won't know that. It's just down there. And we went there, we lived there first. St. Germain's Grove.
And why did you come out to Mask in particular? Just
we didn't want to live in Middlesbrough, and train fares weren't expensive. I mean, they cost money, but it wasn't as dear as you know. And it meant that you weren't at work all the time. So we came to, and I remember Pa said, "Is there anywhere where you'd like to live?" You see, so we said, "Well, we'd seen a house in Mask," and he wanted to know about it. Came to look at it, he said. "Ah, that's all right," he says. "Mind, you're near enough." I think he thought we should have got to live 50 miles away.
Yeah.
When you were married, you left the family home.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't live... People never lived at home after marriage.
No.
You moved. And so we came to Mask. That was how it was as easy. You had to live somewhere, but you didn't want to live in Middlesbrough. And I used to get the train in the morning and at night time. I figured out that it wasn't a lot of money, because it would be sufficient. But then I was on £5 a week.
I was a squire. Yeah.
It's strange. And of course, Mask in those days, there was the High Street and Spain Hill and Cliff Terrace. And that was it.
That was Mask.
We lived here. When we came here, we were the last house in the village. There weren't any houses around here. There weren't any houses around. And that was a little metal road there, along there, like a lane. And the only people that came along were the coal cart, Mr. Kirby with his horse and cart, and funerals going to the churchyard, which were very few and far between. That was all the traffic there was here, and village people never went on the beach.
No?
Never went on the beach. I mean, it was, I don't say never, but they didn't go on the beach like these residents do nowadays. There was a bridle path from the cricket field down the fields along here, past our garden end. And then you crossed the road, went over a stile, and onto the Bitsies, which they call it the headlands now.
Yeah.
It was called the Bitsies then. Then onto the beach. But you never saw anybody walking along. Although there was a pond just where the next first council house is. And I was talking to one of the old villagers the other day, and he said, "Do you remember that pond next to your house?" I said, "Yes, oh yes, we used to drain into the pond." He said, "When we were lads, we've sat there for hours, catching, what did they call them, little lizards, isn't it?
Newts.
He said, we sat there for hours catching newts. But people didn't go past. People went in the village.
Did it take a while to get sort of integrated into the village, or were you regarded as outsiders?
We were never of the village. We never became members of the village, really.
No.
Although we did, we were on the parish church council and involved in things, you know. But it used to be said, if the cobbler put a thick sole on your shoe, we were accepted. Well, we got thick soles on our shoes, but we were, and people, we knew everybody.
Yeah.
People always talked to you and this sort of thing, but you never felt
quite
that you were a member of the village. You realised you were an incomer. For a lot of years afterwards, you were either a villager or you weren't a villager. Oh yes, there was people didn't mention it, but you knew.
You just felt it.
Yes, there were. But In the depression, that's when we came here, you see,
yes,
in the 30s.
Yes.
People would swap an onion for a couple of eggs or a cabbage or something else. And then we were integrated into the village in that time, because we helped where we could. I mean, everybody helped where they could in those days. And St. Germain's Grove. The council houses in St. Germain's Lane backed onto St. Germain's Grove. And most of the council house people were out of work, you see.
Yeah.
And they were kept very good gardens. They made plenty of stuff to grow everything for the house. But they were very hard times. But it was very depressed, Mask, you know, in those days. Very depressed indeed. Very depressed.
So there was plenty of real hardship here?
Very, very great hardship in Mask. And Mr. Wayton was the vicar of Mask in those days, Canon Wayton. wasn't a canon then, and he started woodwork classes in the parish hall,
mm-hmm.
trained them to make things,
yeah.
and they built a boat to go out fishing.
Mm.
He was a tower of strength, was Wayton. He wasn't a very popular man.
Yeah.
He was too straightforward.
Yeah.
He said what he had to say, and that was it.
Uh-huh.
He didn't suffer fools gladly.
Yeah.
And he hated people who scrounged.
Yeah.
He'd give everything he had to a genuine case.
Mm.
But anybody that was laying it on the line, he hated people like that. He was a man, was Wayton. He was a real man. He was a bit arrogant, but. He was a tower of strength in this
mm-hmm.
village,
mm-hmm.
absolutely. And the men admired him.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the depression areas. It was terrible amounts, terrible.
Mm. Did Zetlands help a lot in the village?
The old dowager. Zetlands weren't here then. You see,
no,
they'd gone.
Yes.
The hall was the dower house.
Mm.
And the old dowager. The only time I remember the old dowager. There was an old man called Sinton who used to live at the end of St. Germain's Grove and had the most beautiful garden in the world.
Mm.
It's just a forest now, but it was a beautiful garden.
Mm.
And he was the same age as the dowager.
Mm-hmm.
He lived to be 100, I think. And in the summer, when the garden was its peak, the chauffeur would come from the hall to tell Mr. and Mrs. Sinton, "Her ladyship will be to tea at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon."
Yeah.
And you know, everybody knew that her ladyship was coming to tea.
Mm.
Word went round, you see. And the place was as smart as a new pin. And she arrived in her rolls.
Yes.
And stayed an hour and talked to the Sintons and returned to the hall.
Yeah.
And that was the only contact I ever had with the dowager, the Zetlands. They contributed to the church and always gave subscriptions for anything that was going. But they didn't take an active part in the village in those days. It had long since they'd moved there.
Mm.
But the old dowager was, she had a staff at the hall and very, very faithful retainers, you know, in those days. But you see, she was another age then.
Yeah.
She wasn't only a generation ahead, she was two or three generations ahead.
Mm.
But old Sinton, he worked for Dormans. He was the commissioner at the offices before he retired in Middlesbrough.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a cantankerous old devil. We had a, when we were married, I had a dog called, it's Beauty it was named, but we used to call it Pudge. And of course, living in the town, they hadn't been used to gardens.
Mm.
So when we came to live there, I brought Padge with me. And it would go into Sinton's garden and walk on everything. Because he didn't know what a garden was.
Yeah.
And Sinton used to get mad and
threaten
what he would do to Padge. But you see, Mrs. Beelby had to go out in the war to work. I don't know what it was called now, but she's a trained and nurse. She's actually a sister tutor and a midwife, and directed to work. You were directed to work, so she had to go. So old Padge was left at home, you see, all day, and Mr. Sinton took Padge to his heart.
Oh, did he?
And that they used to tell us to see Mr. Sinton, who was then an old man, and Padge who was getting on. Walking down to the beach to have a look at the sea. It was a sight. And she became used to his garden and didn't walk in his garden. But he took a long time. Yes. But that's the only... I've met the present generation of Zetlands and the one before that on many occasions, but socially, not in connection with the village. But they had an agent here, you know.
Mm.
Very important gentleman was the agent.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, very important gentleman. They were on the corner of St. Germain's Lane and the High Street. Warriner. very important people. He was the Zetlands. He stood in for the Zetlands, you see. He made the decisions, and he had the rotten jobs to do. But there was only the dowager here in those days. But, that's the only time she ever came. I don't know where she came out, but on about once in the year to see Mr. Sinton's garden.
Where did Mrs. Bailey work then in the war? Did you know she had to
work? Worked at West Lane. Well, first of all, the nurse, the Queen's nurse here, was a woman called Brown, and had a heart attack. She used to do the midwifery. And Dr. Holroyd, who was the doctor of the village and the family doctor, was a fine man.
Heard of him, yes, that's
a lot. Nice man. He was regarded with very great respect. And he said to Mrs. B, could she help him out with the midwifery? So she did that first of all. That's a funny, she cost us a fortune in blankets and things. People hadn't anything, you know.
Were home confinement still the normal thing?
A lot of poverty in those days. And yes, home confinements were, everybody had the babies, of course, Mrs. B. So she did the midwifery for a while, and I kept the cooks.
Was this during the war?
This was during the war. And then she was directed to work and went to West Lane, sister tutor at West Lane. And then she went to Poole Hospital and started the first training school. That the girls lived in, didn't go in the wards. And they were trained. And she used to have masters and mistresses from Constantine to teach them at all levels. And she was at Poole. It was a cadet course, but they lived in. It's girls, 16, I suppose, to start at 17. Nice girls. And she did that for a good while, and then they started in Middlesbrough the Central Training School. So she went to open that at the end. She didn't like it as much as they. And you know, I think there'd be probably a couple of dozen girls that went through the school at Poole. And they come here once a year, as many as they can get. They came about 2 or 3 months ago, and have a party, you know, they all bring stuff and talk about old times. And they're all very prosperous and married and children going to universities and things now. But they all, without exception, say they wouldn't have been able to do anything if they had done Mrs. B.
Yeah, that's good.
Yes, yes. It was a great feat to get taken on the staff at the cadet scheme in the Poole. Mrs. B wouldn't just take anybody. And they did well, the girls. Yes, she worked in the war. We both worked in the war.
So where had she done her training?
She trained at the Middlesbrough General.
Yeah.
In the first place, first of all. Then went to St Pancras Hospital in London. Took the accident department on there. And then went as assistant matron and sister tutor at the Royal Sussex. Or the Brighton Municipal, I forget what it's called, one of those. I took her exams at Battersea Polytechnic without any assistance from the state or anything. You had to do it then on your own, you know. Very well. Very highly regarded by the medical profession in this area. And she worked, and we used to go on the train together. And then after the war ended, and you could get cars, we bought a Ford. She used to go up and down in the Ford. And then we got a brand new one, day of days. She used that. Yes, but the war was pretty hard, you know, the rationing was, but we didn't go short of any, we always had enough. But rationing was rather harsh.
Mm. Gardens then helped out a lot, I suppose, maybe.
Well, everybody gardened from necessity, not because he wanted to, it was very necessary that he did garden. And we kept hens, and when we say we kept them, we did, they didn't lay eggs.
We just kept them.
This garden was only half the size. We had a hut where those boards are.
Yeah.
And yon side was Butcher Smith's store cattle field, and had been for generations.
Mm.
And had a mob hole through the fence, and they used to go into his fields. And
he did. About it. Mm.
And I kept bees.
Yeah.
Mm. The minute these houses were built, I had to sell. Well, I gave the bees to a school at Whitby. That one is you're going out on the top. I don't score now. They had an agricultural class. But yes, you had to do all you could to live in those days.
Yeah.
At the time it was hard and the restrictions were very great, you know, but they were happy times, just the same. A lot of sadness, of course. A lot of sadness. But there wasn't as much sadness in the Second World War. The people weren't killed in the numbers they were in the First World War.
Yeah, like in the trenches.
No, no.
Mind you, there was more civilian damage here, wasn't there, in the Second World War?
Well, we only had 3 bombs dropped in Masque, you know.
Mm.
One on the vicarage grounds, one on this lawn.
One here, was it?
Yes, and one in the field. Yes. We all had our roofs to get mended. But we all had shelters in under the stairs, you know.
Yeah.
Huddled in shelters.
Mm.
Yes. But then it was a busy time, you see. You worked all day and you home guarded all night.
Mm.
And Sundays you home guarded. I mean, it was no recreation.
Yeah.
It was easier in the army than being a home guard.
Well, you'd have been busy at the works, wouldn't you? There was no let up there.
But we were busy there. Yeah. Yes, we were busy. But, it was all right. I eventually, in the home guard, got a job in the stores, quartermaster's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
I was all right then. I didn't have to go out in the cold.
Yeah.
But I fitted in with everybody else. You all had to do something. You couldn't dodge the column, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a grand day when the war was over.
Mm.
It was a good day when you were over. But it wasn't as grand as when the First World War was over.
Uh-huh. But you remember that clearly.
Street parties and things in towns. Mm. They had them after the Second World War, but then you had BED and BJ too. But when the First World War was over, it was over.
Mm.
And everybody had been involved. Everybody, all families had lost somebody. It affected everybody.
Mm.
So that... the ending of the Second World War, it wasn't celebrated as much as the other one.
Mm. The interview was done on the 13th of October 1986. The interview was Lorna Mohn.